This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Jay Shell. Our guest today is Sarah Killingsworth, who is San Francisco Bay Area-based California naturalist. She's a wildlife educator with Project Coyote, and she's a conservation photographer. She's a frequent public speaker about coexistence with wildlife, particularly native predators. Her photography has been published in the local and national media, in print and online. She loves bobcats and hopes that sharing her photos will inspire others to love and protect these amazing animals. You can find her photography at sarahkillingsworth.com online. So let's first talk about the ethics of wildlife photography, Sarah. What is it that you cover in your workshops?
Well, there are a number of things that we talk about when we talk about ethics in wildlife photography. And really, it comes down to an approach, a philosophy, which is that ethics really start with empathy. So as a photographer, we tend to be interested in getting the shot, getting a picture that we have in our mind that we might want to use, whether it's in social media or in a publication. And for the wildlife, for animals, every minute is about survival. So they're worried about finding food, finding shelter, raising their young. And so every action, everything that they do is either expending energy or they're consuming food and regaining energy. And so if you approach a photography subject with empathy for the fact that anything you do could cause them to use valuable energy that their otherwise could use for survival, and think about how your presence and your actions might influence their survival, it's a shift in mindset that then allows you to make better choices as a photographer in terms of capturing behavior and also in allowing the animals space to do what they need to do to survive.
So do you do those workshops online or in person, or where do you do them?
Well, so far, COVID has made many things online that would otherwise be in person. So the workshops I've done specifically about photography ethics have been online, but I also view every opportunity to talk to other wildlife photographers as an opportunity to talk about ethics and the way we approach our subjects, because I came to wildlife photography actually out of a passion for the wildlife. Some people come at it from a photography background. I was fascinated by wildlife behavior and wanting to document it and share it with people who might not be able to see some of the amazing behaviors that I've been lucky enough to watch. And so talking to people about how important it is to do research on an animal and understand what their behavior means, because every species has a series of things that they do when they're stressed. And you can tell how stressed you've made an animal based on knowing those tells. And so and an animal will expend as little energy as possible to try and stay safe. So they have an initial response and then a sort of escalating response depending on how threatened they feel.
Right.
And knowing what that first level of response is, which, for example, for a bobcat is they flatten to the ground. Knowing what that is allows you to know when you've stressed an animal and can step back. So I talk about that, you know, with photographers all the time. But the workshops themselves, due to COVID, have been online.
And do you charge for those, or are those just available generally?
So all of the webinars that I've done are free.
Oh, nice. Okay, so what do you see wildlife photographers doing that causes you concern?
Well, when I see an animal that appears to be stressed, that concerns me. And I think many people just, they don't know. They don't know that the animal is stressed, or they don't realize the impact of their behavior. So again, it's about education. But things like simply walking too close to an animal can cause it to be stressed, especially when we're talking about nests or dens. You have parents that are trying to protect their young, and if you get close, even if they don't run away, which they usually won't if they're trying to protect, you know, young, you can be causing them enormous amounts of stress, which again is burning up energy for them. There are other things that people do that I've seen that concern me because they're, again, causing it a use of energy from the animal, which is to use calls or otherwise try and, I've seen people bang on a metal pole to try and startle an owl to get it to turn its head or to fly. I've seen people actually throw things in the vicinity of great horned owls trying to get them to get a flight shot. And so, you know, again, it comes back to the question of ethics and empathy. And you know, wildlife isn't here to perform for us, right? I mean, I view it as a privilege to observe the behavior. Mm-hmm. And I never am trying to manipulate the behavior of what I'm photographing. And so when people start doing things to manipulate that behavior, you know, that owl who hears a call and flies out thinking it's going for prey, well, it's using up energy it could have used to hunt something it could actually eat. And again, I should say, all of these are my personal ethics. There are a variety of views amongst wildlife photographers and birders about the things like calls and other things. So anything I say is my own personal view of what I consider to be ethical when I'm out photographing.
So you're talking about calls. What about using calls to attract an animal?
So calls are, from my perspective, I again think that you're causing an animal to take an action that it would otherwise not take, and I think that's causing it to use valuable energy. It has to work really hard to find prey and consume that energy. So I don't personally think it's ethical. However, there are organizations like Audubon that would say that use of a call judiciously, and for them it's like once as opposed to repeatedly, or, you know, not in an area where lots of people are using calls. So it's kind of, you know, different people have different perspectives on using calls. It also depends on what you're calling to, because there are calls that people use for birds, which they think they might be coming to a mate, which again is part of their survival, right, reproduction. But there are also people who use calls of what sounds like screaming prey for predators. So they'll try and attract coyotes or other predators with calls. And that, I think, is unethical. And then in addition to calls, people also use bait, either live bait or dead bait or things that look like bait. There are little spinner things that sometimes people use, again, for coyotes. So there are a lot of different things that people use to manipulate animal behavior.
So I've been out with guides who have used owl calls to try to attract owls at night. How do you regard that?
So, as I said, bird calls are definitely something that people have differing opinions about. I personally don't use them and won't use them because it feels to me like a manipulation of that animal. Owls are hard to find, but it's possible to do it without the calls. That said, there are many people who are very, I think, cautious and thoughtful, and they do occasionally use calls, and I wouldn't, you know, pass judgment on their behavior. It's just for me personally, I don't do it.
You have some great shots on your website, and I'm wondering how you have managed to get those shots, which don't look like they're that far away, but do you use a lens magnification to appear to be close?
That's a great question, and thank you for those kind words about the photos. I do use a large lens, and so one of the things I do for Project Coyote is classroom presentations, and I always bring my camera because I want the kids to see how big a lens. So I typically, especially with predators, I'm using a 500-millimeter lens. So I am getting a lot of magnification from that lens, and so I'm not nearly as close as it looks like I am.
Okay, so let's move on to bobcats. So why is that a favorite subject of yours?
Bobcats are, just to me, such incredibly beautiful animals, and they have such strength. They're really muscular and incredibly patient. When they're hunting, they can sit over a gopher hole for 20 or 30 minutes, basically motionless, waiting for that gopher to pop its head up and pounce. And so I often joke that I wish I had the exuberance of a coyote and the patience of a bobcat, because they're just a joy for me to watch.
Right.
I've also had the privilege of watching bobcats raise kittens, and that parent-kitten interaction is really special to see.
So where do you go to see bobcats? How do you find them?
So bobcats are throughout the 48 contiguous states, except Delaware really has transients only. But I'm here in Northern California, and we're very lucky in Northern California. The San Francisco Bay Area has a very healthy population of bobcats, and so they can actually be found all around the San Francisco Bay. So in the South Bay, near San Jose, in the East Bay, and I'm north of San Francisco and in the North Bay. So there are lots of different parks all around the Bay Area where there are bobcats, and then they actually are in suburban areas as well. I've had bobcats in our backyard. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I lived in Marin, and I never saw a bobcat. I figure they're pretty elusive to see.
They are elusive, so being able to see them, some of it comes down to knowing what to look for. They do generally avoid humans. They are typically skittish. So, and they are more skittish in places where they're hunted. In California, it's no longer allowed to hunt or trap bobcats. But they do go through human-inhabited areas, suburban areas, and I spend a lot of time looking for them, so I sort of am always scanning and know the telltale signs. Often when a bobcat's in tall grass, the only thing that's visible is the little black tips of the ears, so you have to know what you're looking for to see them.
Are you more likely to see them? Do you find them out in the open?
You do. So bobcats live in all different habitats. They're incredibly adaptable animals, and so they will live in forested areas, in oak woodlands, in coastal scrub, in chaparral, in grassy areas. But when you think about a bobcat's prey, so bobcats primarily, and this does vary somewhat by geographic region, but in California, for example, their primary food source is small mammals. They're obligate carnivores, so they are eating prey that's either small mammals or birds. In fact, there's a video that went viral of a bobcat, actually there are a couple, of a bobcat killing a rattlesnake, which is crazy to watch. I've never seen them take a snake, but they will take snakes and lizards and even fish, I've heard, although I've never seen that. But small mammals typically like gophers and voles and cottontail rabbits and jackrabbits. And so those animals, those prey are typically in grassy areas, so grassy fields. And so when they're out hunting, you will see them. They prefer, there have been some really interesting studies on collared bobcats, and when they're moving between areas, they prefer to stick to the very edge of the brush. So they won't just walk across an open field. They'll skirt the edges along a fence line or along a brush line, but then if they see something for prey, they'll come out into the field and hunt.
Do you find them both at night as well as during the day?
Yes, and the activity level, again, depends somewhat on where they are. They typically are most active either in the mornings or the late afternoon is often a very good time to see them, but they are active at night. They tend to be less active during the middle of the day, except when a mother is feeding her kittens, because they will nurse for several months, but it's not until they're at least 5 months old that they're really even starting to hunt very much. And so she's hunting and bringing kills to the kitten as well as feeding herself. And so when she's in that cycle, a female bobcat has to hunt a lot because, in my observation, she keeps about one out of every three kills and the other two go to the kittens. So she's hunting almost probably three times as much as she normally would be, and that's on almost all day.
So how far north on the North American continent do they range, and how far south?
So they go all the way up into Canada, to British Columbia, and so they overlap with the Canada lynx, and then they go down into central Mexico.
Where do they den? Do they den in forested areas or out on grasslands? Where?
So they prefer to den in sheltered, covered areas. So that's typically something like a rocky outcropping or some downed logs. It can be a very dense area of brush or even under a human habitation or, you know, an abandoned building type thing. So it depends on the location.
How high up will they go in mountainous areas?
There are reports that they go remarkably high in terms of elevation, you know, 7,000 feet or more, but their preference is to be below that. They're not particularly well adapted to the snow, unlike a lynx that has broader feet. So bobcats will go to 3,500 or even 5,000 feet in elevation, but typically prefer sort of low to mid-elevation locations.
So in the various seasons of the year, what do they do in the wintertime in areas where snow collects? What do they compare to? What do they do down in lower elevation areas where there's no snow?
So the bobcats that live in places where it snows are going to be generally larger, heavier animals with thicker fur coats.
Mm-hmm.
And they will tend to hunt larger prey like fawns, if they can, to bulk up. And they're going to seek shelter, but they're still going to need to hunt, you know, the same types of prey. Sometimes they'll go after, depends on the area, but other types of hare, not just jackrabbits, but snowshoe hare in a real snowy place. So the bobcats' geographic range has been moving northwards, in part probably due to climate change and development, making more places that would otherwise have been inhospitable due to snow and cold more viable for bobcat.
So what's their natural longevity? How long do they live?
In California, in the wild, it's generally 7 to 10 years. In captivity, I think the record was over 30 years.
Oh, wow. Quite a difference. And do you know what makes the difference? I mean, why in captivity would they live so much longer? Or conversely, when they're in the wild, what shortens their life?
Well, there are a number of things that impact a bobcat's survival, and unfortunately, many of them are caused by humans. Their primary threat is loss of habitat. So as human development spreads out, they lose areas to live and to hunt. And so their tolerance to a surprising degree of sort of suburban areas and even some level of urban areas if they have adequate green spaces. But anything that's really high-density housing or actually even highly intensive agriculture where the whole area has been, you know, plowed and planted with whether it's grapes or other crops. So it's lost the sort of balance of brush and grasslands that might otherwise be there. They're losing that habitat. And as we develop those areas, we're also building roads. And those roads create two hazards, two different types of hazards for bobcats. One thing that happens is they find themselves needing to cross the road to get to a different part of their territory, whether it's to a food source or a water source or a different den. Bobcats have multiple den sites within their territories, so crossing the road is dangerous, and there are some studies in California, again, about road strikes and how many bobcats are killed, which it's a significant impact. And then the other thing that happens with roads is what's called genetic bottlenecking, which is there are certain roads, usually freeways or highways, that are built that are basically impassable. And they might be impassable because they include concrete barriers or fences or other things that the bobcat can't go under or over in any way. And in those circumstances, you end up with populations of bobcats that are isolated from all the other bobcat populations. And so normally when it's time to mate in the spring, because they're solitary animals and they're territorial, typically a male might overlap with several females, but the females don't overlap with each other and the males don't overlap with each other. So a male would be moving around to breed with different females, and depending on what happens with the roads in a particular territory, it may cut the number of females that can breed, and so you end up with this population that's sort of contained and unable to cross to continue to have a broader genetic mix. And then, in addition to the development itself, when people move into new areas, one of the things that we often bring with us is anticoagulant rodenticides. And rodenticide use is hugely damaging to wildlife populations, not just bobcats, but predators, raptors. There's a number of, you know, nonprofits and educational programs on the dangers of using anticoagulant rodenticides and the fact that when wildlife consumes prey that has consumed poison, that that wildlife is poisoned. Cats, it's really interesting. Bobcats have a unique reaction to consuming those poisons, though. They don't, sometimes they will simply die from being poisoned, but what often happens is they can tolerate a relatively high level of the anticoagulant rodenticides in their systems, but it affects their immune system, and there's a couple different things that happen. It suppresses certain parts and causes increased inflammation for other things, and so they end up very susceptible to parasites, so fleas, ticks, worms, and then also mange, which is like a scabies. So in Southern California, a significant number of bobcats actually died from mange, which is not normally a fatal condition, and they think it's in part because those cats, and it was almost all of them, showed also having exposure to rodenticides. And the studies that I've seen, again, primarily that I've looked at in California, the percentage of bobcats tested when they've collared and tested, you know, done blood work tests on bobcats, the percentage that have been exposed to rodenticides is shockingly high. I mean, you know, it's above 3/4 of them. And so that means it's in their system. And when you think about them as a species, that means when the females are pregnant, the kittens are getting exposed to rodenticide poisons before they're even born. So it's a life cycle issue, not just when they're adults. And the ongoing impact of those poisons is really, really significant.
So there's some poisons that are outlawed in California, but rodenticides are not. Is that correct?
No, they are. So anticoagulant rodenticides, it actually just went into effect. The bill went into effect in January of 21. So before that, there was a ban in California for individual use, but commercial use was still permitted. So you could hire a pest control company, and they could still bring it out to your house. You just couldn't buy it yourself personally. Now they've limited it to very narrow businesses like food production facilities,
mm-hmm.
and public health reasons. So hopefully that narrowing will help the bobcats, but obviously there's been a long-term use of rodenticides in the state of California, so that all of that is still out in the ecosystem to the extent the boxes are out or the things that have consumed it are there. But hopefully over time, at least in California, the anticoagulant rodenticide impact will lessen on bobcats. But it's going to be true that we're unusual here in California to have that ban. Most states don't. So in most of the places bobcats live, that continues to be a significant risk.
Right, right. So how many kittens are normally found in a litter?
So 2 to 4 is typical. The family that I have followed over the years, she tends to have 3.
Once a year?
Yes, once a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so are they territorial? Do they compete with other bobcats or other wildlife like coyotes?
They are territorial, and they mark their territories with scent. In terms of competition, I think I've seen bobcats chase off another bobcat coming through its territory, but again, most species will do whatever the minimum level of expenditure of energy is. So if they can kind of charge at each other and show a little bit of force and then one of them leaves, that's enough. So it's pretty rare to see a true cat, you know, fight of any kind. There's just a sort of indication of, hey, you're in my space, move on, basically, and one of them typically does. In terms of sharing space with other predators, yes, bobcats tend to occur in places that also have coyotes and mountain lions. Coyotes and bobcats have similar prey, but there's typically enough of each. Bobcats, as adults, I've seen them be pursued by a pack of coyotes. It's pretty uncommon, although a coyote will try and scare off. If a bobcat makes a kill, like gets a gopher, a coyote will sometimes try and sneak up and grab it or chase the cat off the kill. I think that's one of the reasons bobcats eat gophers. It's amazing. They sit for an incredibly long time watching a gopher hole, waiting to make the kill. And then once they make the kill, I swear they polish off a gopher in like a minute and a half. The whole thing is gone faster than you would think. And I'm convinced it's in part to prevent anybody else from getting it. But coyotes and mountain lions do both will both kill bobcat kittens. So bobcat kittens are more vulnerable than the adults. Actually, bobcat males will kill bobcat kittens that aren't their own offspring. So the females protect the kittens from males as well.
So they're normal prey or small animals, but will they occasionally attack a deer or even a fawn?
They will. It's a question of what's available, and so here where I observe them, they have so many easier prey sources that they don't take on the deer, but it is much more common in the eastern half of the U.S. for them to take deer and fawn, particularly, yeah.
So are they threatening to people? Can they attack?
No, I mean, the truth is bobcats are far more terrified of humans than we should ever be afraid of them. Bobcats generally will avoid human interactions and don't attack humans. In fact, I had never heard of anything that would truly count as an attack, although there's a viral video of apparently it was a rabid bobcat, and rabies is actually also pretty uncommon in bobcats.
Mm-hmm.
They typically carry it. But so putting aside a rabid animal, which I do wonder how it got rabies because it is so rare, but the only other interactions that I've ever heard of with bobcats and humans where the bobcat behaved in what you could describe as an aggressive manner, and by that I mean scratching or kind of like nipping, is it was a starving bobcat. There was one here in Marin County a few years back, and it turned out that when it was a kitten, all the neighbors fed it because they thought it was cute. And I think they thought probably that they were helping it. This is one of those things where people aren't aware of the consequence. But unfortunately, when you feed particularly young animals, you do a couple things. You reduce their ability to ultimately hunt and learn to feed themselves because they're getting handouts, so they don't learn those skills. And you put them in a position where they view humans as a source of food. And so they will then approach, and this is a problem with coyotes too, not just bobcats. People will feed them, and then coyotes will behave aggressively towards other humans, and it's because they've become accustomed to handouts, and so they view humans as a source of food, and when they don't get the food, they behave, you know, they're wild animals, they behave aggressively. And so, you know, Project Coyote has a saying, a fed coyote is a dead coyote, and unfortunately that's true of bobcats too.
As well. So do they interbreed with other felines like lynx when they are in that territory, or house cats?
They typically don't interbreed. There are a handful of cases where there's an overlap range sort of along the northern edge of the U.S., southern edge of Canada, that there's like a handful of cases where they seem to have interbred with a Canada lynx, but typically no. And they do not interbreed with house cats.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've exhausted our time. I appreciate your willingness to talk to us, Sarah.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation, so thank you.
SarahKillingsworth.com. Look at her photographs. Our guest today has been Sarah Killingsworth, wildlife photographer and naturalist in Marin County, California. Check out her fabulous wildlife photography at www.sarahkillingsworth.com. She's on Instagram at SK Wildlife Photos. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to jswilderness5.net and see additional features of our website. Thanks for your listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.